All right, we will call this committee meeting to order. This is the Monday, February 2nd, 2015 meeting of the Transportation and Public Safety Committee. Members, we will complete the presentations that we started last week, the last two segments that we had from the Department of Transportation that we didn't get to because the first three were so interesting that we had a lot of discussion. Hopefully those will be just as interesting, but we'll get through them, is the pavement management presentation and the project selection presentation. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. We're happy to be here today, and we'll try to answer any questions you have and provide some good information to help you understand our process better.
So excellent.
I'm going to let Glenn Engstrom, is our director of our Office of Materials and Road Research over in Maplewood, which also has responsibility for the Min Road facility up by Albertville along I-94. If you ever go to St. Cloud, you've seen that and driven probably over the pavement there that we're testing. So we will start with Glenn, and then I'll take over for project selection.
And why don't you state your name and title for the record?
I'm Sue Mulvihill. I'm the Deputy Commissioner and Chief Engineer for the department, and I've been at MnDOT about 31 years, so I have a few years of experience under my belt, and looking forward to chatting with you.
Great. Thanks, Ms. Mulvihill. Mr. Engstrom.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Glenn Engstrom. I'm the Director of the Office of Materials and Road Research. Been at MnDOT for around 22 years and the director about the last year and a half or so. What I'm going to try to do today is essentially take some of the mystery out of pavement management and how we select projects, ultimately what gets paved out there and what doesn't in a given time period. Let's see.
I think it's the down arrow.
Okay, I'll be taking the first item in the agenda, the managing our pavement assets at MnDOT. A little background, MnDOT measures pavement condition of all state highways on an annual basis. Our testing involves we drive each road in both directions, measure the following pavement roughness in general. That's what everybody in public feels when they drive over a pavement. Rutting and faulting are two other things. Rutting is when pavements in the wheel path get depressed. That's an issue, especially when it comes to safety, that fills with water during rainstorms. You can cause hydroplaning, et cetera. Faulting is that difference between concrete pavement panels. Often when you're driving down a concrete, well, hopefully not too often, but when you're driving down a concrete pavement and you hear that clack, clack, clack sound, that's faulting. It's little steps that develop over time in the pavement. And you can actually feel 1/8 of an inch in difference between the two panels. It's pretty amazing that you can feel that much. And it also shows that how accurate and how critical performance is. We got to keep try to keep faulting down to a less than that if possible. We also look at cracking and other pavement distresses, and we take digital images of the right-of-way and the pavement surface. So each year we drive about 21,000 lane miles of our state highway system. We drive that every year we drive the whole system. So we have up-to-date information on our entire road network. We're also through essentially a contract with the county system. We drive their system, their county state aid roads and their county roads. We drive those every 4 years. And we're not involved in their decision-making process, but they use our information to manage their payment system.
So, Mr. Engstrom, something I saw a lot of in a few of the counties that I visited this last year was alligatoring. Is that attributable to any particular phenomenon, or is it just a function of age?
Mr. Chair, members, the
this was on county road, county highways. Mostly.
Yeah, I think you're. I have a picture that actually shows that later on, and make sure we're talking about the same thing here. Alligator cracking is usually a terminal distress, I would call it. It's it results generally from it's generally load related, and it's generally in the wheel paths, and it's called alligator cracking because of the blocked crack system. Looks like that. Maybe dimensions are 2x2, 3x3, 4x4 inches.
Right.
Usually those are load-related type distresses. It's also related to time. Obviously, our roads deteriorate. The asphalt actually deteriorates with time, but it's generally load-related.
Senator Kiffmeyer has a question. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you drive any city roads? You mentioned county. Do you drive city roads at all, maybe that intersect with the county?
Mr. Angstrom.
Chair, members, no, we don't do city roads at all.
No city roads?
No.
Too bad.
So how are city roads, particularly arterials, assessed? Do they do their own?
If it's a state route like where I grew up in Northeast Minneapolis, 65, we would drive that. But we wouldn't drive any of the other ones in the cities. They usually contract out to a consultant to have that work done separately themselves. Each city would do that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up. Do you share that information then with the city or do they ask for it?
Senator Kiffmeyer, on like if, 65?
Like that where it is a state highway, but it is also sometimes a city street as well. Oh, is there sharing of data
good question.
That happens?
Good question. Mr. Angstrom.
Chair, members, yes, that information is available to them if they'd ask.
Okay, upon request. Okay.
All right, thank you. Mr. Angstrom.
Okay, thank you. Good questions. This is a van we use. We have two of them. One does state highways. One does county roads, like I said before. The picture shows our array of sensors in the front. They're a laser system that measures the rutting that I mentioned before and the roughness. We've also got cameras in the back. This is about as up-to-date system as there is available in the nation. It's a typical profile from a pavement van. This shows the roughness. If you were to measure the pavement as you went down the road, this is what you would see. This is obviously compressed and expanded. We don't have roads that look that rough. But it's typical of the information we use. We use our process. I can't say this enough. Our process is data-driven. All of the information we use to make our decisions is gathered by these vans, and we use that to make our decisions. The Ride Quality Index is a measure of that roughness. And we use a scale of 1 to 5. It takes the previous data I just showed you and rates roads anywhere between very good to very poor. You can see in the bottom part of the slide. But I think what's important to note here, this isn't just some engineer determining what's poor and what's good, et cetera. We actually go out with people every so often, and they ride around in cars, and we correlate what they think is poor to what we think is poor, et cetera. We find this very valuable, and we looked at it over time, and it stayed actually pretty consistent over time. And one other thing I'd like to note is when we say a road is poor, it is poor, meaning our definition would relate to if you're driving down a road and you actually have to take evasive action to miss a rut, to miss a pothole, et cetera, That's what a poor road is.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kent.
Thank you. On that point, if I can just clarify what you were saying. So do you have those types of criteria that go into each of those categories? Or is this basically everybody rides around and says, we agree this is what poor feels like?
Mr. Angstrom.
Mr. Chair, members. We have the previous slide showed the roughness, and that's we actually measure a criteria called International Roughness Index, and that's a number that comes up. And we correlate that number with the scale very good, fair, poor.
Okay.
So we take that number, we correlate that to a poor, very good, et cetera. So we do use a number eventually.
Thank you.
Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Senator Chair. Just to follow up on Senator Kent's question, I heard it was this coffee cup test. I literally, somebody told me, you know, if the coffee cup is full and on the day, it probably isn't applicable anymore, but, you know, that was shared
that,
with me.
I had that problem because I just can never find my cupboard. I don't know what I do with them. I lose them.
Well, I don't think anyone, find them. Mr.
So,
Chair.
You know, I go to work in like a regular coffee cup, and this morning my coffee cup was sloshing.
Yeah.
At least it didn't land on my clothes, which was good.
I mean, it's Jess, but I was told at one time that there was some sort of correlation to a coffee cup test. But.
Mr. Engstrom, coffee cup.
Chair.
Coffee and coffee cup.
Members. I think that was probably before my time. But
maybe just Northern Minnesota, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I'm going to start selling covered coffee cups in northern Minnesota. All right, Mr. Engstrom.
Next picture shows the back of our van, and it's hard to see, but it does show our 3D laser system, and I'll show a picture in the next slides of results we get with this new data that we collect. Try to go through this information from the left to the right. The left is actually, it's a real picture of the roadway. You can see cracks here and there, essentially. The picture next to it is actually a 3D representation of the roadway, meaning the darker areas where the laser goes down farther, it's a farther distance, it's actually showing that crack. That's not a photographic picture, that's a laser image. And that will be really valuable because currently we have a staffer that sits and counts cracks, measures cracks for severity, et cetera. We're looking, hopefully, in the future to automate this. You can imagine that job is tedious, et cetera. Thank goodness she really likes her job and does a great job. But it's something we're looking in the future. On the right shows that, again, that longitudinal profile I told you that gives us that IRI number for the measure of the roughness of the system. The bottom one shows a transverse profile, and you can see the ruts, those depressions, both sides there, so we can measure the rutting. We have triggers for rutting that we meet to make sure that the road is safe.
Mr. Engstrom, are we looking at one lane or both lanes, or how? What are we looking at?
Mr. Chair, sorry, good question. That's one lane.
Okay. So those two ruts would be like the wheel tracks?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
That's typically what rutting looks like on a highway.
All right. Thanks.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Wieger.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Mr. Engstrom, what percentage of Minnesota highways that you have jurisdiction would be in very poor for rating?
Mr. Engstrom.
Mr. Chair, our representatives, our latest data is, I'm going to have to turn here and make sure I get this right. The pavement management engineer is right behind me.
Lifeline.
For our total system, we have interstate, we have NHS system, we got 9 NHS. It's 4.8% is in poor condition right now.
And Mr. Chair, and for poor?
Poor condition.
And very poor?
Very, Mr. Chair, members, very poor. We don't have any in very poor position.
Zero.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
So, Mr. Engstrom.
The next slide shows our other significant rating, and that's surface rating. And that's essentially, like I said before, where we measure cracks, we measure severity of cracks, we measure length of cracks, we measure potholes, we measure depressions, et cetera. And this is what we call our surface rating. You can see on the right it varies from 0 to 4 based upon all those criteria. One thing that's significant to note right here is that you can see our pavement management van and our basically collects those two information and the other things. It looks at the surface. We really, to know what the problem is out there, we really work with our districts to determine the proper fix. This is like, if you go to the doctor, beginning examination. If something's going on, you're going to need more work done to look at really what the problem is and how to fix it. Which would, for us, that would entail something like taking cores, test pits, et cetera, to see what the problem is in the field. Talk a little bit about the history. MnDOT's measured payment performance and targets.
Mr. Engstrom.
Sorry.
1 second. Apologies. Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Engstrom, we have lots of frost heaves up north, and I they look way worse than that crack you just showed. And at some point, driving down 169, it's like going across rumble strips. How do you determine when those should be fixed?
Mr. Engstrom.
Mr. Chair, members, usually it's related to how severe they are.
Rumble strips really
what
bad.
What the root cause is. Some areas, what's really important with frost heave is to make sure that the base soils, the underlying subgrade is uniform, and then when it heaves consistently. So if you have pockets of sand and you have pockets of silt, that's not good. So you're going to have silty areas and frosty areas.
So, Mr. Chairman, so you basically have to dig up the entire road in order to fix it, right?
Mr. Chair, members, that's correct, and that's why they're so very expensive to fix. You have to do a total reconstruct. You have to go down a minimum of 4 feet at least to get rid of that frost issue.
Because just for an example of something that works up on the Iron Range, there was a subsidence issue for underground mines right outside of Chisholm, and the way you fixed it was with, I think you called it a land bridge, and I think it was actually a 1 foot thick slab with a whole bunch of rebar in it. And there's no frost heaves there at all, but on either side of it, it's really, really bad. And I don't know if spending more up front is a good way to solve some of these problems or if it's so that they don't give us bigger problems in the future, but the frost heave issue has never really been figured out up there, and it's you fix it 1 year and next year it's bad again. So
is this in a spot with a high water table, Senator?
No, this is where the underground mines were. There was there were about 8 levels of underground mines, and and they found that they were really worried that there was going to be subsidence into these mines, and
that's right.
And the highway actually did sink in one spot at one point and created a great big crater.
Sure.
So this fix is really, really neat. I mean, there's no frost heaves here at all, and it's been there for several years now. So,
sure. Mr. Engstrom.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, I was involved in that project. I remember.
Oh, you did a good job.
with the mines, it was quite the ant's nest of mines underneath there, trying to find out what was there and wasn't. And we used a technique called ground penetrating radar to find where they were, et cetera. But you're right. When you do it right from the beginning, you eliminate those type of issues.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. Continue, Mr. Engstrom.
Okay. Typical uses of the report in the past was report to top staff and legislatures, estimate funding needs, compare conditions with our districts, estimate the impact of potential funding proposals and track system trends. We find it very valuable on the research side to look at our payment management data to try to improve the way we design and build our payments. Okay, on to selecting payment projects. Projects are currently chosen primarily based on their condition, meaning current, past, and future, age, maintenance, construction history. Payment engineers, like I said before, look at other factors. It's not just the roadway. This is just one part of a project, and we'll get into that later. We also have safety needs, maintenance needs, other nearby projects, culvert issues, et cetera. Currently, we divide our projects into two areas, projects on a national highway system. They're chosen with a centralized approach. Primary reason that is because of the new MAP 21 federal requirements that require the state to have a certain level of performance on the national highway system, and that includes the interstate. The rest of the projects off the National Highway System are chosen at the district level with their separate funding. Okay, we'll get in some data here. On the y-axis, essentially that shows pavement condition. What's critical to note here is you can see the number 2 there. That's where we're saying a pavement is in poor condition. The dots, or actually the triangles, represent the measure of our ride at a certain time. You can see we had, it was declining there at the initial part, those 3 dots going down, and then it went up. That represents a fix. That's where we went in probably with an overlay or something, and we brought it up to a higher level, up to around 4 on the index. You can see the other dots represent each year the measure of the pavement as it gradually deteriorates. The line there represents our predicted model. How this is based upon the section itself, but also historical data from other similar sections. So we have our best guess on how that's going to perform over time. This is a critical part of what we're trying to accomplish with our pavement management system. This is called a decay curve. Okay, the next chart just shows 2 separate prediction models. We've got the red. Red is one roadway or one section, and the blue is another section or roadway. Again, showing the actual measured condition. The lines represent, okay, if we want to fix this in, let's say, I think it shows 4 years there, we look at the decay rate predicted, and then we say, well, we're going to fix it, and it'll get up to that level around 4 again, and then we predict decay rates again. This is the kind of information we use to manage the system long term.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wondering, in your prediction model, I know we've talked about different surfaces, white topping versus black topping. Is that a factor in your model, or is that just weather and traffic related?
Mr. Angstrom.
Well, good question. They are related to the pavement type. So these show both actual deterioration, and if we put a different fix on it, we would look at what we think it's going to look in the future. But we also look at similar projects with similar conditions. Again, it's our best engineering guess in this situation. But, yeah, the models will definitely look different depending upon pavement type, pavement thickness, the actual, like the question before about issues with frosty, things like that are all looking into, taken into effect.
Right from the cathedral to the end at 400 feet down.
Thank you. Continue.
Okay, how we use the prediction models. The first one there, we enter a predetermined program, list the projects, and see what likely performance results are. That's where we have our 4-year program known as the STIP. Another thing we've been active in recently is enter anticipated budget and determine the most likely performance results. So we can take pretty much any number that people throw at us and work till the middle of the night and give you what results would be determined with that number. And we can also determine the funding needed to reach certain performance targets. Let's say if the MAP 21 requirements were such the poor had to be 1%, we could put that into our model and determine what the needs are to meet that. So it's a very robust model. It does a really, really wonderful job of determining basic needs of our payment system.
Okay. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Engstrom, to make sure I'm understanding this correctly, is there the opportunity to compare options and say, okay, with option A, it may be cheaper up front, but over the long term, it's going to cost us more, and option B, we're going to pay more for it up front, but it's going to give us longer life per dollar type analysis?
Mr. Engstrom.
Mr. Chair, members, the model looks at, and I'll get into this a little later in a couple slides, it optimizes the system, which is a really important point I need to make here. It doesn't optimize each project. It optimizes the system based upon the dollars given.
All right.
Thank
so
you.
Hold on to your question and mm-hmm. see if it makes sense in a couple
no,
of slides.
All right. I hear.
All right. Mr. Engstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And again, when we go through these potential fixes, that we call them, for various roads in various conditions in various areas, et cetera, we use these decision trees. They were developed by our central office in conjunction with our materials engineers from each district. So if you have a certain type of distress, you go through this decision tree and it says, you've got this distress, you should look at this fix. If you've got this situation, you got this. So it targets you to a certain fix. And these have been, I would say, reasonably accurate over the time that we've used those. Again, they look at the most appropriate fix, which, again, is not necessarily the best fix. Analogy that I always like to use is if people that have homes, you can't afford, the best siding, the best brick necessarily, the best insulation, the best driveway, whatever, you optimize based upon your needs. You can't necessarily afford the best fix in every area. This is a fairly simple. I showed you before the decay curves, and again, it shows on the left the pavement quality index. On the right is basically, on the bottom index is time. It shows if you do nothing, what the curve would like to failure, the decay curve, and then it shows in the green line there in the shaded in area, if you fix that, what would happen in that colored area, the blue area, is that that's what we're optimizing. That's our area under the curve, we call it. We're trying to optimize that area to give the best fix for the system. So that's what you can imagine we're fixing, let's say, 150 different sections in 1 year or so. We have to optimize that fix. Each one of these projects fixes has one of these curves, and the program looks through that and tells us where we're spending our money the wisest for the money we have. I talked about this a little bit earlier. There are limitations on the data. It's surface. Only surface information is shown. Second bullet there, pavement management segments aren't necessarily what you consider a project. They vary on basically the cross-section of the roadway, and that can be extremely variable over the years we've taken to fix roadways and initial construction and overlay here and work there. So we combine those together. I believe we've got upwards of 4,000. There's several sections of roadway that we have out there. There are other factors, like I said before, about safety, mobility, maintenance, history, utilities. It all works into a project. Most projects have a lot more than just pavements going on, and we work with the other areas to make sure we're doing the right thing at the right time. My last slide here talks about district collaboration. We have to work with the districts on this. Again, like I said before, this is just is the initial look. We go back and forth with the districts to determine if they agree that this is a good project. Do they have more information, core information that they need out there to look at some of the subsurface characteristics? Again, it takes time, but we feel it results in the best possible project for the citizens.
All right. Questions, members? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's very interesting. Learned a lot.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Glenn. As stated before, I'm Sue Mulvihill. I'm the Deputy Commissioner and Chief Engineer for the Department of Transportation. I'm going to talk a little bit more in depth about how we select projects in MnDOT, and it won't answer every question about project selection because we select about 500 different projects each year as part of our State Transportation Improvement Program. And within the STIP, that's our four-year program, there are about 2,000 projects listed in there. And right now, I think we're on from 2015 through 18, and we'll be selecting projects for 2019 this year. Right? Head's nodding. That's a good thing. I want to thank our Transportation System Management Office folks for helping put together the presentation. I think I saw the first draft of this about 9:30 on Friday night, so I appreciate the work that they put into it to get it ready for today.
I'm glad we didn't get to it last week then.
Huh?
I'm glad we didn't get to it last week then.
Yeah, well, it probably would have been a different presentation than Mr. Chair. But, you know, more revisions, more refinement.
Yeah, excellent.
So we'll talk a little bit today about the criteria that we use for project selection and the process and some of the decision points that are in there along the way, including the opportunity that we have at numerous places for the public and the stakeholders to put in their comments about projects or the program or our vision overall in the Department of Transportation. So when I said vision, we do have a 50-year vision for our department. It's called Minnesota Go. It represents really the vision of the agency. It's consistent between that and our agency. It is the multimodal transportation system maximizes the health of people, the environment, and our economy, and that's really what we're trying to do with Minnesota's transportation system from a MnDOT perspective. From there, it goes into our statewide multimodal plan, which is the policy and strategy. It takes the vision document and kind of puts it into some policies and strategies that we try to follow as a department across the state as we develop projects in our program. And then it goes into the MNSHIP, Minnesota, the State Highway Investment Plan, which is our 20-year plan, and projects are selected within MNSHIP. In the years 11 to 20, those are more conceptual projects, things that we'd be looking further out in our pavement model or our bridge model to kind of determine. And then years 5 to 10, and of course years 1 through 4 is the STIP I just talked about a couple minutes ago. We use performance measures and performance goals to look at some of the things that are happening MNSHIP. I'll call it MNSHIP. In addition to the needs of the local area, the region, the district, the dollars available, and then some of the priorities that go along with how we get from a vision to a program and then into the construction of different various projects. So along this process, starting way from Minnesota Go, that was probably an 18-month or two-year effort. We went around the state and talked to a lot of different stakeholders, had different opportunities for public and customer input to develop Minnesota Go. We have a lot of opportunities for meetings. We use interactive websites for folks to put in comments about the vision. Do you think what we're talking about is a 50-year plan for our state in transportation terms is good, is useful, is going to work? We get input from local agencies and advocacy groups like ADA or groups that need special accessibility to our facilities. And in addition, the Build Your Own Budget Calculator is something that was on our website where when we were going around with the MNSHIP plan, folks could take a certain dollar figure and distribute it amongst the various categories that we had available to kind of give them a sense of when you're looking at different categories for transportation investments, what are the sort of trade-offs that you need to make, and folks would have an opportunity to do that. I mentioned meetings around the state. There's a thing up there called webinars. We did provide some webinars for folks who could not travel to one of those meetings located across the state. So we try to provide as much opportunity for input as we can. In addition to social media, we're active on Facebook and Twitter and all of those things, and we get a lot of hits and things like that to use for pretty much anything we do at MnDOT, including if you're having a bad day on the road.
Ms. Mulvihill. Yes. Senator Franzen has a question.
Thank you. To that point, Ms. Mulvihill, did I say that correctly?
Mulva Hill, yep.
Thank you. Question with regards to how many meetings do you regularly hold on any given year, or how long is the process? You probably get to this eventually in the presentation, but how long does that evaluation process and public input process take?
Ms. Mulva Hill.
Mr. Chair and Senator, it right from the very beginning, when we start collecting information from the pavement model or the bridge model, and the districts are identifying what they know from their local experience as items that are issues on their transportation system, there would be opportunities for input. We take emails, phone calls, whatever, and we try to make sure that we're, at least in my experience, we're keeping track of those for different parts of the system. Now, as far as just numbers of meetings, that kind of depends on what district you're in and, you know, what Rotary Club opportunities you have or local agency meetings that you can go present at. We have public hearings for many of our different kinds of projects. So throughout the process, there's a lot of opportunities. It kind of varies from place to place and across the state.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ready? Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sendrum.
If I could just maybe... follow up a little bit rather than wait with my question. Ms. Mulva, you've probably always been intrigued. I've always kind of wondered, okay, like where and when. I think we're getting to at least the point of maybe you can answer both one of those, but who? You know, you say we take input or we do this, and I expect we in that phraseology is all of MnDOT, but there must be a time when, if we go back to your previous slide and we talk about the 20-year program, the 5- and 10-year program, there must be either, I would expect you would be part of this group, probably the commissioner. Is it a small group within MnDOT then that takes all this vast statewide input and sits in a room maybe over the course of several days even and decides we're going to list this one, this one, this one, this one? I would expect the leadership of MnDOT puts the construction rehab program together. Is that correct?
Ms. Mulvihill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sendrum, at a certain point at the end of the process, a group of high-level folks within the agency, myself included, our CFO, other deputy commissioner, our division directors, they do look at the STIP and the plan that is put together by the collaboration of the central office, expert offices providing information, the districts taking their local needs and bringing those to the plate, working with the area transportation partnerships. So at the end of the process where we gather a lot of input, we talk about it at a functional and district and local level and a regional level to figure out what are the projects we want to put forward. Then there's a process where we get together, all the districts get together, and they look across it as a statewide program to figure out, you know, are we missing anything that's of great regional importance? Is there a specific project in here that's going to cost more money than any one district can provide or support by itself? And should that be a higher priority for some reason than other things that are happening at the local level? So there's a district central office, kind of a statewide leveling, if you will. And then the districts also then provide another opportunity for local citizens, agencies, whatever, to provide input to the projects that are listed in their portion of the STIP. We incorporate that into our process and thinking of whether or not we should move any of those projects or change them. And then after all of that, it comes to the central office, and we have a meeting where we look at the district programs. We hear from the division director who's in charge of operations and engineering services, who are the folks that have done a lot of work up to this point to get it to a program. And then we'll either make recommendations for approval or not of that program. Most likely by that time, several of us have been involved in some of the discussions. There's been a lot of vetting, a lot of discussion up to that point. And so generally, unless there's something we know from a statewide perspective or something from the governor's office or the legislature that's come up that we need to adjust it, the program gets approved at that point. And then the commissioner has the ultimate responsibility to sign off and say, okay, yeah, this is our 2015 to 2018 mm-hmm. STIP. I sign it, the deputy commissioner, chief operating officer signs it, and the commissioner signs
okay.
it.
Okay.
So, Ms.
Go ahead.
Sorry, Senator.
Well, maybe just a follow-up. And so, Ms. Chair and Ms. Mola, you'll be going through that process now, or you have for 2019, so you are looking ahead, I mean, which is good, I don't mean that, but you're contemplating what the needs are in 2019 or 20 at this point, is that right? And going to put these projects in the basket, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sundjum, yes, that would be true. And not only that, we don't just concentrate, in my experience, on something that might be happening in 2019, but if there's things that we know that are coming up beyond that, we'll also kind of look at those. We really want to be thinking about this as we go, because when you program 500 projects a year, it takes a lot of work to get those all prioritize and put into your project list, figure out what are the resources needed to deliver those projects, either inside the department or with consultants. There's a lot of things that go into it. So we'd be looking at 2019 probably before now and for sure this year.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I see you. I just want to make one quick comment, Senator Newman. So, Ms. Mulvihill, I think some of what Senator Sundjum asked is covered on subsequent slides, is that true? The steps,
yes,
one,
sir.
Two. So what I would encourage you to keep in mind as you're presenting those steps is how does the whole wide world know about these things as they're occurring? That's the crux of this hearing.
Mm-hmm.
How do we know, how does everyone else in the whole wide world know that this is even happening, when it's happening? And, of course, the implied question is how do they know and how do they participate and influence those discussions. So beyond, I mean, I know there's the ATPs, but no one kind of knows who they are, how to get onto them, and all that stuff. So,
oh, okay.
So, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Mulvihill, going back to the selection of highway projects, I think you mentioned that you've got maybe 2,000 projects currently going on around the state. Incidentally, driving around the state of Minnesota last summer, I think I hit every one of them, to be real honest. This is a bit of a clumsy question, but it's anticipated by a lot of folks that we're going to have a significant infusion of money into the transportation system coming out of this session. At least we hope so.
All right. All right. I'm with Senator Newman.
At some point, does an infusion of money, in effect, exceed the ability of MnDOT to go forward with projects that you feel are needed? Or even a worse way to maybe phrase the question, with a significant infusion of money, do we exceed the ability of you to spend it? It's a funny question, I understand, but at some point, are you able to, with MnDOT employees and contractors throughout the state of Minnesota, et cetera, are you able to, with a significant infusion of money, speed up the process, from just a practical standpoint, speed up the process of what has to be done in terms of our roads and bridges in the state?
It's an excellent question. We've actually run into that in the past, Senator.
Yeah, and so,
excellent. Ms. Mulvihill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman, I will tell you that if we get money, we will deliver. We will do our best to deliver it. There are several methods by which we deliver projects. Alternate delivery is one of them. You've heard a design build that helps us just bring a project to 30%, and then we hire a consultant, and our folks work with a consultant, and the contractor gets on board, and we kind of design as we go. That's design build. We have Our Winona Bridge is being built by construction manager, general contractor, CMGC. That's another new method that helps us deliver projects in a faster method, different fashion. So we're open to using alternative delivery. One of the things that you'll see that people will talk about is that there will be a request or some dollars for project delivery with any new funding package, and that would be to enhance our project management staff so that the folks who actually help deliver and develop projects within our districts are skilled to the level that they need, and I think we need a few of those folks to do that work. And our construction inspection and construction administration folks. So in answer to your question, if we it will impact our ability to deliver, but we will figure out how we do it, and it will be a mix of internal staff that develops and delivers projects and working with our consultants, consultant industry in the state here to help us deliver it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have Senator Jensen and then Senator Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I could go on and on about this, but I won't, Mr. Chair, just real quick. I participated in a lot of the public.
To go on and on,
so. Okay. In a lot of the public things that happened in regards to Highway 14, which is in my district, and considering the implication of the 20-year plan that I heard you talk about in Tessenjum's question, it was on there, and then it came off, and it was a project that's gone back and forth, and I understand some of that. But when it came to the public meetings, we were in Mankato, and the presentation was, here's what the survey we sent out, here's your response, here's what you came up with, here's what the department came up with, and here's why we're doing what the department came up with. And that was what was presented to us. So for people in my district and for myself to get a good understanding of how this 20-year plan works and how the public can be involved, especially during different times of the day, because the meetings that I went to, there were government officials there because it was always during the day when people couldn't come. There was a few that were at night that just showed the plan after it had already been decided. So I'm very involved in that process. But what I heard you say in response to was that the state takes an approach and looks at the regional importance of that list, which that part I didn't understand before. So can you explain that a little bit more, how then that regional importance happens and then it comes back down? Does it ever go back to the state? Because what I heard you say, so correct me if I'm misunderstanding this because I really want to understand it. You go through all the local stuff, you do that, it goes to the state does its thing, and then it goes back to the locals to have the meetings and all of those things. Does it ever go back with any more input after that?
Ms. Mullahill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Jensen, there might be a slide a little bit later that explains this a little better. The regional importance part of a project would be, I would call those a regional community improvement projects that we have, RCIPs in our program, which is about 10% of our investment priorities in a year. And that is where a project like a Highway 14, we know there's accident problems along there. We know that it's a two-lane road that folks have wanted, four-lane for quite some time. Amongst all the other priorities of the state, it hasn't necessarily risen to the level where we'd fund it above some other things. But the region around Highway 14 is very concerned about that and has made it a priority for us and for their area. And so when I talk about regional community improvement projects and how the opportunity for having the region say, this is really important to us, we need to think about it, perhaps put it higher on the state's list, yeah, it does come back to us, and that's what happened, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Reinert.
Thank you, Chair Dibble. The question I wanted to ask is a follow-on to Senator Newman's question with a slightly different angle and I hope anticipation of some significant investment into especially our roads, bridges, transit system.
Senator Reinert, too.
Oh, I think, Mr. Chair, you could count me in before
right,
now.
But
you know, one of the concerns I have heard from just knowing staff, and I'm in Duluth, so we're District 1, is sort of, I don't know if these will be my words, maybe a withering of the internal capacity to process projects. So if there were an influx or an increase in investment in these projects, you know, are we prepared to handle that? And I know that there is sort of the proposal to just take more advantage of contracting, and I think that has its place. But I do become concerned about sort of completely turning over our internal capacities to contractors. So when we get a flood of 2012 in Duluth, that, you know, that MnDOT has the capacity not just to process the projects we know about, but the unexpected things that we can't anticipate. So, again, I think it is sort of a tandem question to what Senator Newman asked in terms of what is our capacity currently, and would a significant investment maybe make this what I perceive as a problematic situation worse?
Ms. Mulvihill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Reinert, I echo your concerns about that. We do not want to have a MnDOT that is not strong technically, that can't evaluate work that is done for us by others, consultants, or whoever it would be. In District 1, we have been working with them specifically to help address what you're talking about, the need for more project management staff to help deliver those things. And hopefully we don't have another 2012 flood, because that was, you know, beyond the usual work that we do. But they do, when I mentioned before project management staff and increasing those folks within our agency, we would be looking at doing that to help us expand the capacity of folks in those jobs to help us deliver. In addition, we have a project management battle, which is part of our enhancing financial effectiveness goal. We're working on spreading out our lettings across the year in a more effective manner, which will help us deliver more systematically, I guess I'd say, and it's helping contractors as well, because we're spreading out the lettings earlier in the year. But as part of that project management battle, we've implemented a new project management software called P6. And P6 allows us to roll load, R-O-L-E, load projects, so that we will know for, I think, 2016 and 17 projects. For each project in our STIP, we'll know what kind of staffing levels we need, who specifically we need, if it's an engineer or a technician or whatever, on those kinds of projects, and we'll be able to determine what the level of staffing is that we need to deliver internally, and then we'll be able to augment that with consultant staff to help us deliver. So we're working on getting both better at what you're talking about and being able to look at what do we need to hire internally to help us.
Mr. Chair.
Senator
Ryan. A follow-up. Thank you. And I don't want to discount our private partners. You know, in Duluth, LHB Engineering and Barr Engineering are both great partners and have been on projects not only in Duluth and northeastern Minnesota. I'm just concerned that along the way we don't lose sight of having the internal engineering and technical capacity to not only do projects but to have sort of the baseline knowledge to be a good partner. We just can't turn over all of that skill set to somebody else.
Ms. Mulvihill, you said project management battle?
Yes.
Who are we battling with?
Project management battle is a term that it comes out of Covey's four disciplines of execution.
Uh-huh.
It's the framework that we're using for our wildly important goal, which is to enhance our financial effectiveness, and project management is just one of those battles. It's one of the strategic things that MnDOT needs to work on to make sure we're good at it and we can continue to deliver over the next many years. And so part of project management is balancing the letting. The next effort we'll be doing is cost and budget management for projects. But really the battle is just the terminology we use as part of 4DX.
So that's just an expression to articulate effort to improve? Battle implies conflict, internal conflict, or conflict with someone.
No, Mr. Chair, far from that. Let's see, what would I say? In Covey's four disciplines of execution, uh-huh. the top thing that you want to accomplish, which is for us is enhancing financial effectiveness, is termed a war. That's the war we're trying to win. And if you want to win the war, the next term down is battle. You have several different battles that you fight on different fronts that help you accomplish winning the war. And right. So that's where the battle and war thing come from.
We're going to have a Covey workshop next. All right.
Okay.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Senjum.
And I really apologize, but these are precious moments. and I don't want to act too parochial, but I just need to, and you got to know Senator Jensen and I live at on both ends of this Highway 14 bookend, and that has been going on for all of my legislative life and before, and I would dare say you could hardly find anybody associated with public works at all in southern Minnesota, at least central southern Minnesota, that doesn't believe Highway 14 is important, and, you know, from a commerce point of view, a business point of view, a safety point of view, and so on. And we've been drumming this for an awfully long time. But and just be, I'm trying to be polite and forthright, and I know you'll at least be forthright, and you don't have to be polite. But can you just tell me, irrespective of all our arguments, then we have not, I don't think, been able to make the top 20, if you will, and that's maybe our failure. I don't know, but is that kind of where we are? We just don't stack up in the eyes of a central view high enough to make that list, so to speak, because we have to go home and kind of convey some of this information to our people that we report to. So I just kind of want an honest answer. And I understand we have a big state and a lot of needs, and maybe we just don't stack up.
Senator Senjum, I'll jump in briefly. I mean, it's not like we haven't done nothing on Highway 14, substantial resources through corridors and some other efforts, you know. So, I mean, Highway 14 is a very long stretch with a lot that needs to be done, and it's not going to be done overnight, but Your question is a fair one, Ms. Mulvihill.
To be honestly fair, you're absolutely right. We chip away at it and so on and so forth, and I think we got about 15 miles left. But at least for us, we don't see that 15 miles in the foreseeable future, at least on any list that I know of. Maybe I'm wrong, but so that's where we sit, and I guess we have to kind of report that maybe except for some corridor or commerce money, it'll do a mile or two or three, but getting that last 15 miles is going to be seemingly a long time. Is that kind of where we are?
Ms. Mulvihill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Senjum, I believe right now, if I'm not mistaken, we're purchasing right away for the easterly section from Dodge Center to Owatonna, right?
Okay.
So we are working on purchasing the right-of-way for that as part of, I think, Corridors of Commerce in 2013. Okay. I think that project is about $120 million, and I'm looking this way because Mark manages our program. So it takes us a little bit to get the money together from the RCIP category to be able to do a $120 million project. But we are working on it. Your words chipping away is really kind of what we're doing, because for every Highway 14 we've got, I have a 53 up north and a 23 in Wilmer and a Highway 2 up in District 2. And so we really try to balance the needs based on – that's part of that statewide discussion that we have at the operational level, where the districts and the central office and folks like me get together and say, okay, how does all this stack up against each other? Because as much as I'd like to do every Highway 14 project, I have probably 50 of those in the hopper at any one time. Okay. So we really are trying to work on Highway 14. I do know we're looking at the segment out to the west over toward New Ulm as well right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've taken too much time.
No. It's excellent. You're the one who keeps raising this. How does the list get made, and how do they come down to... So this is the Senator Senjum Memorial hearing here.
Mr. Chair, remember Senator
Vickerman? You and Senator Jensen have been the most 16. Persistent one. How does it happen? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I heard the list of highways, and I'm like, I was just waiting, thinking I-94 certainly would have made the list. And so I just wanted to be sure, Mr. Chairman, that we have equal treatment of these areas that I think I probably know about as much about Highway 14 now, as even though I am not down there too often. But I'll tell you one thing: most everybody drives through I-94 at some point in their years. So I just didn't want to go without just mentioning it.
Nope, we are elected to represent our areas. So appreciate that, Ms. Mulvihill.
Mr. Chair, duly noted, Senator. Let's see, where am I? Okay. So I talked about MNCHIP, the State Highway Investment Plan Program, and really this is the investment priority pie chart that we use. These are the categories of investment that we put the funds into. This is our 10-year program, if you will. And you can see the green parts there are a lot about managing assets, infrastructure, pavement condition, bridge conditions. The blue is Twin Cities mobility and other kinds of mobility projects that we have. There's a small portion for traveler safety, and that might look small, but in every project we do, if there's safety items that need to be addressed, we try to address those. And then there's the regional and community improvement priorities that I had mentioned before that are projects that are important to the region and that get put into our 10-year investment plan. Talk a little bit about asset management projects. One of our goals at MnDOT, I'm going to fill this up, is to keep our assets in good condition. The roads and bridges represent a really large portion of the state of Minnesota's assets, and that's part of our job is to make sure we take care of those and keep them in good shape. We use the pavement model that Glenn talked about earlier to look at pavements all across the state based on a certain level of spending or different opportunities for looking at what kind of pavement should we be doing. We also have a bridge condition model that we look at that prioritizes bridges across the state and helps us look at their age, their structural capacity, things like that. So we use that information on assets to really figure out how we're going to maximize the investments that we make across the state on all of these things. We have plan outcomes from MNCHIP that set certain levels of investment for us. We also have FHWA targets, Federal Highway Administration, the MAP 21 federal legislation that we get some funding from, and we look at pavements and bridges as part of that because part of MAP 21 is asset management. And our agency is one of three states that are working on a pilot program called the Transportation Asset Management Plan, and we are helping to kind of shape how asset management is done across the nation as part of a pilot project. We also look for continuity and coordination with other state or local agencies. Senator Newman, I think, said that he drove through all the projects in the year last year. Summer, was that you or was
everyone.
That? There you go. We try pretty hard every year to coordinate with local agencies to make sure we don't have a I-94 and a Highway 10 under construction at the same time in the same area because that's really frustrating not only for you but for me too. And so we try very hard to coordinate those projects and make sure we don't have every person disrupted every day of the summer construction season. So we also have metro mobility projects. Anybody who's been caught in congestion here in the Twin Cities area can happen any day. Happens much worse if there's snow or rain or some other thing that coordinate or congests our system. We really are looking for opportunities to help people have a reliable trip across the Twin Cities because I think probably the most frustrating thing that people have is the expectation that they think they can get somewhere in 15 minutes and they get in their car and they have 15 minutes to get there and it takes them 45. We get a lot of folks that are not happy about that, so we try very hard to make sure we have available capacity. We look at crashes. Making sure that lanes are continuous and that people don't have to shift lanes. We drop them in bad spots that may make bottlenecks. We look for technology improvements or operational kinds of improvements that we can make to select our metro area mobility projects. And a couple other things here. We look at strategic capacity enhancements, which could be adding an interchange or a roundabout or a non-priced managed lane like an HOV lane in places.
We look at priced managed lanes, which is the MinPass system, which provides transit or high occupancy vehicle users the opportunity to use a MinPass lane or those folks who are willing to pay. We look at spot mobility improvements that are really just to relieve bottlenecks for a cost-effective price if we can do that. And then our active traffic management systems, the ramp meters, the changeable message signs that tell you it's 7 minutes if you're going to go this way. And a person may make a different choice if they have an opportunity to do that and they know that their trip is going to be longer than they thought. So I talked about regional community investment priority projects a little bit, and really we look for a lot of local input on these projects, folks who live and work in the area and know what the situations are, like Highway 14, that would want to talk to us about what's going on from their perspective. They are regionally important projects for the area in almost all cases. They have a high potential to help the economy of the area. They improve the quality of life for folks in that area. On a small scale, these projects are called, municipal agreement projects or cooperative agreement projects. So MnDOT would have some money in those. A municipality might have money in it, or a county, things like that. And at the bottom it says, and others, flood mitigation is something that comes to mind there, because if we have a bridge or a culvert or a piece of roadway that we know goes under when we have a big rainstorm or in the spring consistently, we would try to make improvements to that to help the local area have a better opportunity to get through there. And then also we have other programs. These are just a few that I mentioned before, but we have a safety program. Oh, we're going like that. We have a congestion management air quality that helps provide more transit services to help minimize the amount of pollution we have in the metro area. Our TED program has been very popular, helping us provide interchanges or intersection improvements. Corridors of Commerce, I mentioned that before. We had $300 million in bonds in 2013 to address Corridors of Commerce, and we're working on those projects as we speak. And then CIMS, Corridor Investment Management Strategies. Just a brief project that we've got there is Highway 52 and County Road 9 between here and Rochester had an accident problem, and we identified a way that we thought we could grade separate that, yet not have to build a complete total interchange. It's called a quadrant interchange, but it provides basically the same accessibility to that local county road, and yet it removes the conflict from the intersection that used to exist on Highway 52. So that was a CIMS project, one of our really good ones. So how do we select our projects? And really, this is getting into the programming of it. There's a little pyramid here that we put together. At the very top, we're talking MnSHIP, the four-year program that we've got. It's a yearly process. Annually, we look at a number of different projects with a lot of input, like from the pavement model and the bridge model. Our technical experts in traffic or maintenance, they come with their set of projects or issues that they would like to resolve on various pieces of the roadway. So you can see we identify projects, we develop a draft list. That's some of what I was talking about before without the benefit of these slides, so we'll step through the rest of these. It really is from the top to the bottom a process of we have a lot of information about a lot of different roadway segments or bridges or issues that we know to be true or that we hear about from our local partners. And then we refine it down based on different inputs, safety issues, crash issues, maintenance stuff, drainage structures, other infrastructure. All of those things kind of get put into the evaluation of what should be our set of projects that comes out at the end and when we approve the STIP and the next year. And you can see that step six is public input, but truly we are open to input along the process, which I think many of you have provided in the past.
Ms. Mulvihill, we have a question. Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Mulvihill, I heard a lot about your criteria or some of the criteria that you used mentioning, and I haven't heard congestion as much as I would assume it would be a huge factor. Of course, safety and the pavement conditions and bridges condition, but also how much the change in congestion. And I have a particular example in mind. It's in my district. It's part of Highway 62 from Edina all the way. That's the route that I take every day. And we've had a presentation in the city of Edina saying how that particular project to expand it to an additional lane, there's already some of the land has already been purchased, and it has less of a price tag compared to what I'm hearing in some of the other projects. So I know that the project was now – I've been mentioning it since I started here because of the issue of congestion, and it seems like the right-of-way is already there for the most part, not all of it. So in terms of cost and congestion, it seems to be one of those that is particularly ripe for consideration. And it wasn't until this summer at the State Fair when I was talking to MnDOT staff that they told me that there was actually a study being done. And maybe it's because I've been bugging them enough that it came up. But how does that happen? How does it come to being a study? And what does that mean in terms of the overall project scope? Because I don't see that in one of the steps. Maybe that's in step two, identifying projects and you then study them. But in that one in particular, I think it also has risen to attention because there's certainly more people supportive of it and stakeholders supportive of it, such as the airport for obvious reasons and the city of Richfield and Edina for certain. I've spoken to them and they're supportive. So is it because of that level of support and maybe that I know we had the city engineer from Richfield come to a meeting in Edina, and that's how we realized that a lot of that right-of-way is already available, that it wouldn't take that much to move it forward. So now the study that I've heard about is to look at a managed lane, so which I would support, certainly. So how does that work in terms of a study, and what does that mean in the process? Are we 10 years down the road, or does it mean that we're now actually looking at it more closely because it's got more viability?
Ms. Mulvihill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Franzen, as far as doing a study, that is part – it's in the upper part of the process where we'd be collecting input and helping to identify projects and then exactly what is the right fix for that particular section of road. When your city engineers start talking, and I know Mike Eastling, so when the city engineers start talking to each other and they work with MnDOT, we try to identify what is the right fix for this area. Because if we try to buy right away along Highway 62, it could be really expensive. Sure. In addition, there's a lot of wetlands right along in that area from 77 to the west. So we would a study would fit up in the top one or two steps there, and that would help us further refine what is it that we really want to do and what are the kind of inputs that we need to put into the project development process beyond that. Now, we've done studies sometimes that wait a long time, but for a MNPAS study, we're looking at a number of different segments of roadway throughout the metro area that are potential MNPAS candidates for the future.
Sure. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In regards to the SIMS program that you mentioned, is this used also on county roads as well, the SIMS money?
Well,
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, I'm going to turn around and look at Mark. Trunk highway only.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, I think, though, they might be influencing because I think of the effectiveness of some of those small changes. I know that my county has just redone a county road, and some of those low-cost things as far as go-around lanes, left-turn lanes, a whole variety of things that they've done have helped the traffic to move more smoothly, more safely, and yet with a lower cost than I think some of the projects sometimes do. And so I just wanted to say something about the program because I think it is there are the places where it's appropriate to use it, but I didn't know that I'd heard the SIMS money mentioned by my county, so I wasn't sure if they use SIMS money or if they just stole your good ideas and applied them in the county.
Ms. Mulvihill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, we're always happy if anybody steals our good ideas and uses them somewhere else. Likewise, we'll steal theirs if we find some good ones. I want to ask Mark one thing. Was the diverging diamond on Highway 15 in St. Cloud a SIMS? Okay.
SIMS projects are often cooperative, like the county.
Yeah. So Sims, like I mentioned, Highway 52 and 9 down towards Rochester, you know, that's a county road crossing, so that is definitely a place where we could benefit, where potentially we don't need to spend the big interchange money, but we can do something that will improve it and help both the local system and ours. So we're sure open if they want to use any of our criteria or anything like that. We would work with them to help identify it.
Okay. So I have a odd question on what we're talking about. Innovative fixes like this. So in New Jersey, where my dad lives, they do a lot of what they call jug handles, where you circle around. If you want to take a left rather than taking a left, I mean, I think it's pretty land intensive, but you exit to the right, kind of circle around, and then cross the freeway that you wanted to take a left off of. Do we do any of those in Minnesota, any jug handles?
Mr. Chairman, I don't recall any jug handles. Do you know of any? I have seen them in other states as well. The benefit that you have is they take you off to the right, they kind of bring you in at a square, and you're not trying to take a left off of the main road where potentially there would be left turn problems, and then you can go straight across. We use what we call a reduced conflict intersection that does a similar thing. It kind of avoids those left turn accidents, but it brings you a little bit past the intersection and then you turn. So okay. It's similar, but it's not a jug handle.
I've never seen one in Minnesota. I was curious if we had any. They're all over New Jersey. They take up a lot of land, though, so I'm not crazy about them.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else? Okay, continue.
Keep going. Okay. So just looking at step one at the top of the pyramid there, you know, we use the bridge and pavement models. We look at system performance. There was a question before about life cycle. I think Senator Kent asked that. We do look at life cycle because when you build something, there is a time when there's going to be maintenance needed to it to keep it in good shape, and we want to keep that life cycle as long and effective as possible. We generally, when we get especially from the pavement model, it's segments of roadway that are identified as possible fixed locations. So we'll look at, what are the segments in between one place to another and figure out, does this fit together using some common sense as a one project or what is it that we should do? We also look at, safety, congestion. There's your congestion. Oh, she left the room. And accessibility for folks, and then any local priorities expressed by local agencies, legislators, general public. In my experience, I was a traffic engineer probably 20 years ago. We'd get a lot of input from folks about crashes, intersections that were problematic to them. Those were always things that went on our list to kind of look and make sure that we're keeping track of what was happening there so that we could keep them on the top of our mind as we look through what was going on for our customers. We look at the pavement data and information that we get, the theoretical data, and then we ask the district folks who are more familiar with their local agencies, the people that live there and work there, to take a look at the theory, and then what are the real things that we want to try and fix or change here in their local area. And it really does add a lot to the projects for them to be able to identify what are the local issues that are impacting these pavements and bridges and other things around here. We also look at...
Ms. Mulvihill, we have a question.
Well, it's on this slide, so she can do this slide
first. All right. I guess you're about to answer it.
Keep going.
Had a question, but if you continue on, I think the question will be answered.
Okay. So. Yes, sir. So when we're looking, we look at a number of factors. Other investment needs is just how does everything stack up against each other. That's kind of the big Highway 14 versus 94 versus 23 question on a statewide level. We look at that at a local level as well. We look at community impacts to try to see what is, is it going to cause an undue burden? How do we match up with their CIP program? Because a lot of times theirs are 5 years and ours is a 4-year cycle. So how will the funding match up if there's something that needs to be supported by a local agency? Look at maintenance operations concerns. Our maintenance folks are out there every day looking at the roadways, so they know a lot about what's going on. And then really we just take all of that input and try to figure out what is the priority for projects in our area and how do we want to stack them up.
Right. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. So, Ms. Mulvihill, on the slide that had the boxes with how the process works, this falls under step two or step one, because where I get
concerned is now we say stakeholder input is taken at step two. Mm-hmm. From who this goes to send him to. Who is that? Because later, almost near the bottom, is the public. So these are other people, and this speaks directly, I think, for me, to the who is out there that you're getting this information that you need before you even develop the draft project list, and then it doesn't go to the public until after they've had their input, and then it's drafted, and then it's figured out, and then we're seeing what it is. Do you understand? So I just need some more clarity on who is the stakeholder input that you're getting.
Mr. Chair, Senator Jensen, stakeholders can be anybody from the public. It is local agencies. It is customers who have concerns. If along the course of your daily work you get a comment from a person about a project, I used to keep these in a file about that roadway or that intersection or whatever. I don't know how individual people are doing it, but stakeholder input at step two can be the public or any member that uses our system.
Quick follow-up. So do you see any way to make that more of a formal structure rather than just whoever in whatever district and different across different districts, somehow formalizing that in some kind of these are the people that participate so that individuals can know who's making those decisions?
Mr. Chair, Senator, there are a lot of formal pieces where folks can, there's public hearings, there is opportunities for involvement at the, you know, at the MNCHIP level where we're talking about projects. Can we make it more formal or more, there's area transportation partnerships that take input into all the projects that go in. There's a lot of opportunities today. Not that we can't provide more or more information or figure out a better way to communicate how people can provide input to us, and we will certainly work on how we might be able to do that better. At any one time, I would say if you're having concerns about that, your district engineer is a good person to talk to, or the district planner or project management person that develops projects in your local MnDOT district is a good person to send folks to.
Thank you. That works for me, but not for members of the public, I don't think. So somehow I'd like to get that.
And just for members and for MnDOT, so Senator Jensen is nothing if not consistent, and there's actually some language in the proposed bill around this, and so we'll have more conversation about what that might look like in terms of an initiative or a pilot or a practice. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And would this be a situation where an ombudsman department is helpful to a local resident? And maybe Ms. Mulville Hill would be willing to talk about that just for 30 seconds so that all the members are aware of the services that are provided by the agency.
Ms. Mulville Hill, on the ombudsman. Who may or may not play a role in this process or others.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson. Our ombudsman is a function that looks at the process that we've followed, whether or not it's has followed the right process, has been fair, has been not impartial, I guess I would say, or has been impartial. So the ombudsman is available for anyone who has a concern or an issue about how they have been listened to or heard at MnDOT, and they take a number of cases each year. And anytime that you would want to find the ombudsman or anyone, actually, you can go to the MnDOT.gov webpage, and I'm sure under if you just type in ombudsman, it'll come up there. But it's been a very valuable a group of folks for us because they help us kind of look at ourselves too, because sometimes you get a little involved in engineer think and you're not thinking so much about social or economic or those kinds of things for the people who live there. And then we really rely on them to help us look at it maybe from a different perspective. So the ombudsman is a good suggestion, and they help us kind of review what we've done. What you're looking for?
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I, from my perspective, we've used that office in the past when we've had constituents that have specific complaints, they certainly have a chance to talk about their situation with other people in addition to our office. And as we all know, as much as solving a problem, people need an opportunity to be heard, and certainly that office allows that to happen. And so I think it's a valuable service that each of our offices should continue to use, particularly when we have constituent complaints.
Thank you. All right, Ms. Mulvihill.
All right. So after we've gone through the identifying list and looking at the other criteria, the districts look at what are the projects that they have in the hopper, how are they prioritized against each other. They work with the central office, specialty offices, like our pavement road research office, our bridge office. We have a traffic safety and technology group. We have an environmental services office, or environmental stewardship, I should say, to really refine the list of inputs and potential projects that have come in up until this time. We look at the Minship priorities, the 10 investment categories that we had on the pie chart that I showed you before, whether it's asset management, RCIPs, safety, those kinds of things. And then we really work at the district level on how do we fit this into the dollar amount that we have available as a state to be able to decide what projects get accomplished. This is where the district engineer looks at the projects in his or her own district and says, yep, those are good to go forward. And then we step to the next part of the process, which is review by the specialty offices to make sure we're looking at it from not just a district and local area perspective, but across the state, what are the things that we want to be looking at as a priority for our agency? How do we prioritize them in the way that I talked about before, where we get together and we balance projects? That's the next slide here. But really, if any changes or adjustments need to be made based on what we know from our specialty office perspective, we will make those adjustments at this time when we look at the project list of all the districts together. In addition, we look at what are the programs and the funds available within our agency, and where's the money coming from, because trunk highway dollars can't be used on non-trunk highway purposes, and federal dollars can be used some places and not other places. So it takes a little bit of thinking to figure out how to really match up the list of projects with all the inputs that come from a statewide level. And then this is where I talked about the districts and the central office. We get together in a big room, kind of like this, look at the Minship plan. What did we say we were going to do? How does that match up with Minnesota GO and the multimodal transportation system plan? And we look through each district's proposed set of projects to make sure that they uphold the vision of Minnesota GO and the multimodal plan, and the Minship investment priorities that we've set for everybody to kind of take as a, here's what you should be looking at. We further refine that proposed list. We address any regional or statewide issues. You know, if a Highway 14 needs to come up higher, or a 94, or whatever it is, we'll look at that. Is there a reason for us to change that? And then we kind of balance out the program at a statewide level at this balancing opportunity.
So Ms. Mulvihill, yes. Senator Kiffmeyer has a question.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering, one of the things that over the years I've heard about is that the districts are apportioned money, a certain amount of money by district. In particular, the District 3 that I live in gets about 85% of the generated gas tax, I think it is mainly revenues, back to District 3. Some of the other districts get more of a higher percentage of that. And so my district has been a bit disappointed quite a bit because kind of that expectation is has been there. The other thing is that the understanding was I thought there was more of a district decision on using those funds, and that they were mainly to be focused on maintenance rather than new roads, that maintenance came first. So with making those comments, just wondering if you might address some of those issues.
Ms. Mulvihill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer.
We are over time, members,
okay.
Answer briefly and then race through the end of your presentation.
I have heard
Thanks.
About the specific issue that you've talked about with District 3. We've been up there to meet with them several times. It used to be that each district got a certain portion of money, and they figured out how they were going to spend that locally, and they didn't talk to each other to figure out what are the real statewide priorities that we need, or like a 371 that we just funded here not too long ago. So we have improved that. That a district doesn't necessarily just get its own little pot of money and that's not enough to cover the needs by doing a statewide performance program and a district risk management program. So I understand your concerns, and we've talked about it before. You are correct that we are looking more at preservation and upkeep of the assets that we own today as opposed to building new roads. In any location, really, because that's where our system's gotten to. We have 50-year-old pavements and 30-year-old bridges, so we really need to be maintaining the assets that we have. So we are focusing more on preservation than on building new roads. So.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll just close up with that. It in my district, there's a little bit of feeling that these were kind of the rules of the game, and so people waited patiently, thinking, and then the rules are changed. And just about the time we're ready to say, okay, we're going to do some of that, because our district has been quite good at doing exactly what has actually been a longstanding practice, not just something recently, but a longstanding practice that maintenance was to come first. So just about the time that here we go and our district, my district has been doing that, then this thing comes along that that changes that. And it's really disappointing because when you've been patient and you're doing that and then feeling like now when our turn came, those things are going on. So I do know that I think the Corridors of Commerce has been helpful in that regard, but these are a variety, as we can tell from going through this today, there's a variety of factors that come into play here. But there's still this situation that I'm wanting to really look forward to maybe seeing some balance in that regard. And I think we're not the only district in that sense of having that. But on the other hand, Mr. Chairman, we're at the end of our time, so I just know that you're going to be having more opportunities for this, so we don't have to get it all in right now, but to at least bring those topics, and maybe in the future they could be returned and revisited if we could. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Mulvihill.
Mr. Chair, and I would say we'd be happy any time to meet with you to talk about that further if you want. Mm-hmm. So then we come back. Again, we have this is the opportunity that you saw at the bottom of the pyramid, more public and stakeholder involvement. There are lots of opportunities. I won't say that everybody always knows about them as much as we would like them to, nor do they take advantage of all of those opportunities. But we will continue to work on that, because public input and stakeholder input is very important to us. We want to be doing the right things for the folks that we serve. And actually, I will say one thing there. We do take the comments seriously that folks send in, and we adjust accordingly to things that people send us. Then the district engineer will make any other final adjustments to their individual district programs based on the public input that they've got, any stakeholder input. We look one more time at the finances and the program just to make sure that we're meeting the goals that we've set for ourselves. And then, like I said, we bless it at a senior leadership level, and the Commissioner of Transportation gives final approval for our program, which is our STIP. And that's the end of that. I had an example project, but maybe we'll save that for next time. Or if folks want a specific project, we can talk about those too.
Great. Well, as you can tell, Ms. Mulvihill, there's a lot of interest in both of these subjects, as well as the three that we covered last week. So no doubt we'll talk more about those really, really important aspects of how MnDOT provides its services. So members, we meet on Wednesday, and we're going to start hearing MnDOT's proposed budget. So that'll be another opportunity for us to have these kinds of conversations. With that, we're adjourned.